That was such a lovely, peaceful song that I'm worried quite how I'm going to get into the subject I've been given, which is the Christian athlete. And it sounds a bit more upbeat, perhaps, than that lovely reflective mood that we've just been put in. And I'm fully aware as well that some of you will be looking at me and thinking, why on earth did they choose him to talk about athleticism? And I agree with you. But I wasn't always this shape. And far be it from me to boast, but there was a time when I was, I think, 14 or 15 years old, when I was chosen in Sports Day to take part in the triple jump. And on my very first attempt, I equaled the world record. Admittedly, it was the world record for the long jump, not the triple jump. But, you know, it was an achievement of sorts. Bob Beamon's famous jump for the long jump had been achieved at altitude and with a tailwind. So, I mean, whatever. Paul uses a training athletic metaphor in the reading that we heard earlier in the service. And it was a metaphor that would have been very well known to the people in Corinth, would have made a lot of sense to them. Because the Isthmian Games happened just around the corner from where they were. And they happened every 2 years, and they were second only to the Olympic Games in importance and in stature. And every city and several towns from most of what was then the known world would have wanted to compete in them. And most of these places would have built in their town a gymnasium where the best of their young men would be sent to train so that they might bring glory to their hometown. And they would be expected to go not only to visit this place once or twice a week or even every morning to do their training, but to live there for 10 months up to the games, to be totally dedicated to what they were trying to achieve, to sacrifice their favorite foods, to sacrifice their friends, to discipline themselves solely for that purpose. And today we know that if we want to do something athletic, maybe if we have an ambition to run the marathon, then we can't just dream about it and then one day go out and do it. We have to put in the training. But equally, I'm sure we all know people who talk about it a lot, say that one day they will run that marathon, but actually, they never quite do. Years ago, a good friend of mine was best man for another couple who were both friends of ours, and he gave a brilliant speech. I remember huge chunks of it, even to this day. And one of the best laughs he got was when he referred to the happy couple, and he said, well, Chris, of course, and Julie are a very sporting couple. Chris excels at all sorts of different sports, and Julie has all the clothes. A little cruel, perhaps, but Julie herself knew that there was more than an ounce of truth in this. You can't just dream about it. If you're serious about taking part, then you have to put in the training. Over the last 24 hours, of course, there have been all sorts of tributes to Muhammad Ali, and all sorts of his quotes have featured in the media. And some of them are very boastful, and some of them perhaps we raise our eyes at. But one that I did like was when he said, the fight is won and lost far away from the witnesses, behind the lines, in the gym, out there on the road, long before I dance under these lights. Yes, he was a showman, but he also put in the hard work. Now, of course, Paul isn't talking about athletic training principally. That's just the metaphor he uses for the spiritual training that he put himself through and that he expected of the people in the church that he'd founded in Corinth, that he would expect of us as well. So what does spiritual training look like if it isn't pounding the roads early in the morning or going and swimming those lengths before breakfast? Well, it's not rocket science. We all know, even if we don't always do it as we should. We need to be studying God's word. It's not enough just to hear a portion of it read on a Sunday and think that that will get us by. We need to immerse ourselves in it. That's why the life groups in this church are so important. That's why in Lent, Tessa was challenging us all to take on a deliberate regime of reading our Bibles. But we need to do more than just read our Bibles. We need to be a prayerful people as well, which is why the week that we had recently of 24/7 prayer was so exciting and so valuable. And it's why we're hoping that that doesn't just wither on the vine, but that actually we all commit ourselves to being slightly more disciplined about our prayer lives going forward. Why we've been talking recently about forming prayer triplets. And we need to worship together. Worship is so important because it takes the focus off us as individuals. We live in a society which is very me, mine, my rights, what I can get for myself. But by coming to worship, whether we realize it or not, we turn that focus and we turn it onto the one that matters, onto Jesus and onto his Father. So we need to know our Bibles. We need to pray. We need to worship. But again, we need to worship not just on a Sunday morning, but 24/7. We need to step out and lead worshipful lives in all that we do. And it will be hard work. Perhaps that's the main point that Paul is making. It won't be easy. There's a lovely quotation from a ballerina who had achieved great fame and made everything look so easy and graceful as she danced across the stage. But she was wise, and she said, "In life as in dance, grace glides on blistered feet." There's a lot of hard work, and we're all called to do it. Why? Well, the clue is in the first half of the reading that we heard. Paul says that he makes himself a slave to everyone. And why does he do that? Because of the apostolic commission that he had received directly from the risen Jesus. Paul's overriding passion was to bring the gospel to those who hadn't heard it yet. And as Ray was talking about last week, he was determined that there would be no stumbling blocks in the way of people hearing the good news. And so if that meant that he had to get out there and talk in a language they could understand, behave in a way that they could relate to, then he was willing to do that. Paul was a proud Roman citizen, and that gave him all sorts of different rights in the empire. But he didn't hide behind them. He didn't stand on those if getting down off the pedestal would mean that he could reach people for the gospel. Paul was a very learned Pharisee, but he used that knowledge when it was right and he was talking to Jewish people, but he set it aside when he was talking to others. In the culture of the day, respected preachers and teachers would be expected to go around and visit different places and would expect to be paid for their services. But Paul thought that could be a stumbling block. And so he practiced his tent-making trade, sometimes long into the night, so that he could be self-supporting and proclaim the gospel by day. Because he knew he needed to be involved in a huge variety of different worlds. He needed to be all things to all people if he was to preach the gospel of Christ. He knew that it was vital, but he also knew that it was dangerous. Vital because the church that he'd started in Corinth, even when it had grown to some considerable size from nothing, was perhaps 300 people. And yet there were 30,000 people and many visitors in that place. Those ratios perhaps are similar to what we face today. There are significant numbers of people who still go to church, still call themselves Christian. But more and more, there are larger numbers of people who don't. People who haven't heard the gospel. People who won't hear the gospel from anywhere, if not from us. No longer will their parents have church experience, even if they don't. In fact, in many families, not even the grandparents anymore will have grown up in a time when it was usual to go to church. They may not hear it from school, as they would have done in assemblies in the past. So where are they going to hear from, if not from us? That's why this church is thinking seriously about employing an associate minister for evangelism. But of course, it'll never be down to just one person. And each of us has to ask the question, are we willing to step out? And have we trained ourselves to be able to do so? Will we be scared of what might happen as we step out into the unknown? Yes, probably we will. But do we yearn for people to know Jesus? Hopefully so. One writer put it like this. Are we scared of the ocean? Yes. But do we love those who are drowning? One of my earliest memories is from when I was, I don't know, about 3 years old, I think. And we were on our summer holiday, Torquay, I believe. And I was playing on the beach with my big sister and just dipping a toe in the water, which was far too cold, and then I'd run away again screaming and I'd go and do it again. But eventually I got rather braver than I should have done. And I went in, perhaps not any further than my knees, but suddenly a wave came and whipped me off my feet, turned me upside down, and started dragging me down the beach. Within an instant, my father was there. He couldn't swim. He wasn't particularly fond of water. But thankfully, he loved me more than he was scared of those things. And I was fine. Are we willing to put aside our trepidation about what might happen because we love Jesus so much and because we want others to do the same? It is vital to reach people, vital to relate to them on their own terms, but it is also dangerous. Dangerous because when we go out into a world, we may become like it. We may drift into bad practices, even though we promise ourselves we won't. One of the remarkable but not very pleasant pictures in the press this week was of the former British boxer, Ricky Hatton, who has apparently forgotten all the training that he did when he was involved in the sport and was pictured in Benidorm eating a Benidorm breakfast, which was 14 slices of toast, several sausage, many rashers of bacon, a whole pool of baked beans, and on and on and on. Oh, and then chips on the side. He had perhaps drifted into the ways of the world rather more than he had when he was an athlete. The church can face the same temptations. Some of you will remember from some years ago a service called the Sheffield 9 p.m. service, which started off with exactly the right motives and was reaching people through nightclub-type music and worship in that style, but went off the rails, and a lot of harm was done when a lot of good had been intended. Those are big examples, but each one of us will face smaller instances of knowing where do we bend to what we find in the world and where do we stand firm? What do we join in with and what do we say we need to walk away from? When does jokey banter that we might be happy to join in with suddenly switch into becoming cruel bullying? When might blasphemy be something that we turn a blind eye to? One of the apparently, you know, most used set of letters in texts is OMG. Are we comfortable with that? I remember a time when I was working for the bank and we were looking at some marketing figures that had come in and they weren't very good. And one of my colleagues used the name of our Saviour as a swear word to describe what he'd seen. And our senior manager was a Christian, and we thought, how's he going to react to this? But he just very gently said, would you not say it like that, please? He's a friend of mine. And there was no offense taken, but he had stood his ground. He had said, I can't say that that's right, even though I'm not going to make a huge deal of it. When is proving that we're normal good and the right thing to do? When is proving that we're different important? I don't necessarily have the answers to those, but they're questions that we must ask. And I think the hint of the answer comes in something else that Paul says in the reading. He says that he is free of legalism, but he's under Christ's law. And we could have a whole sermon series on what that means. But at its simplest, it means what Jesus taught, the greatest commandments, love God and love your neighbor. And the fact that that is one commandment, not two, in the way that Jesus says it. We love God by loving our neighbor. And so we may need to decide when our principles are getting in the way of the basic instruction to love. Many of you will know the story of Eric Liddell, which was featured in the film Chariots of Fire some years ago. And he famously took part in the 1924 Olympics and had been picked to run in the 100 meters, but the heats were on a Sunday, and so he refused to. And God is good, and he gave him his gold medal in the 400 meters instead. What is slightly less well known about Eric Liddell's story is that he went on from his time as an athlete to be a missionary in China for years and years. So nearly 20 years after those Olympic Games in 1943, he was still working as a missionary in China, and the Japanese invaded as part of the Second World War, and he was taken into a Japanese internment camp. And one day, the two huts within the camp had managed to organize a makeshift hockey match between themselves. But they were from different cultures, and they couldn't quite agree on what the rules were, and various arguments were breaking out. And someone came to Liddell and said, look, everybody knows you. Everyone knows you're a man who can be trusted. Will you come and referee for us? And it was a Sunday afternoon. And the man who had refused to run in the Olympic Games on a Sunday very happily went and refereed for them, because he was doing God's work for God's glory, not just running for his own glory. Liddell was able to check his motives and decide when it was right to bend, as opposed to when it had been right to stand on his principles. And we need to be able to do the same. Why? Because, as Paul says, we're not just involved in shadow boxing, but we're in a real spiritual fight. And being all things to all people is vital, but it is also dangerous. But the positive outcome can be spectacularly good. Training is great in growing our faith muscles, for helping us achieve the full potential that God sees in us. And even better, a set of fit individuals make up a very potent team. When we're all involved in growing our faith muscles, then that can turn people like us into a church that God can really use to build his kingdom. Paul says, run in a way to get the crown. And his metaphor falls down slightly because there could only be one winner in the Isthmian Games. Any race only had one victor. But in the race of life which we're involved in, the prize is on offer to us all. There's no need to push others aside so that we can grasp the crown. And the crown that we will get will not be the sort of crown that they received at the Isthmian Games, a laurel wreath or made of the local leaves which would rot and die before very long. It's not even an Olympic gold medal that the athletes after a while put in a drawer and forget where it is. we are offered the eternal crown. The eternal crown that is to come, but for which we need to start getting fit now, because the race starts in this life. For Paul, living in the light of eternity meant relationships with adaptability and a disciplined pursuit of personal holiness, so that his evangelism could have integrity, so that he could see God's kingdom grow. I pray that we would have the same faith, the same resolve, and that we would see the same results.